Hello, this is Janet Gallen welcoming you to Love Letters Live. Today's guest is something a little unusual for this, only because I have never had the pleasure of an actual politician. And I want to introduce Janice Kamener-Resnick. And just tell us what you're running for and what it is you're doing. And then I have some questions, because who doesn't have questions for politicians?
I never considered myself a politician. My name is Janice, and I'm running for the California State Senate, Senate District 27, which covers a vast area in the West San Fernando Valley and Simi Valley and Santa Clarita Valley and Malibu and Topanga and Thousand Oaks and Westlake Village and Coneo Valley.
My goodness. Okay, so that's huge. And I shouldn't really say politician. I should really say public service. How do you, just for starters, what made you think you should be doing this? It's a brutal business from what I see just as an outsider watching campaigns and watching people try to get things done.
It actually wasn't my idea. I was recruited over the last couple of years to run for this particular seat because of the waning number of women in the California state legislature.
Oh, okay.
So this was not an idea I dreamt up on my own. I'm an activist. I'm a lawyer. I've been doing a lot of things in the community. And when the women's community was looking for a viable female candidate who could run in this massive district, they tapped me and spent about a year and a half trying to convince me to do this.
You know, that makes sense, because if they're looking for a representative, which is technically what you do if you're in office, you're representing people, then they should get to choose who's going to represent them, even to get you to do it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the problem for women and female representation in the legislature is, I think women as a general rule don't see themselves as fundraisers, as powerful people, and there's too few women voluntarily who will opt in to being a candidate, and which is why you need an organization like Close the Gap to actually recruit women to do this.
Okay, so that's perfect that you said that about women in office, because I heard somebody, Jennifer Lawless, I believe is her name, and she teaches, it doesn't even matter, but she's wonderful, and she gave a talk a long time ago on women in politics. And she said, if I recall this correctly, and if she's listening and I get this wrong, you can just call me and correct me, that women, when they do run, they get elected as often as men, and they raise as much money as men, and the problem is they just don't run very often.
Yeah.
And I think it's because women are just tired of being in the position, a supplicant asking for money.
I think that's part of it. I think there's a lot of reasons that militate against women running at the same pace that men run for public office.
What don't they want to do?
Well, one of the things, some of it is what they do want to do. When they're 30 years old and a lot of men first opt into running for office, a lot of women are not at a point in their life where they want to either be bi-coastal if they want to run for Congress.
Right.
They don't want to be living in Southern California or living in Sacramento when their young children are in Southern California. So a lot of it is the age at which women decide to have children. And somehow men have no problem separating from their kids to run for office, to be bi-coastal, to not live in the same city.
Well, that's kind of a leftover from when the women were home anyway, no?
Probably. And it should change. Mm-hmm. And women should be able to have the option. We should have better childcare options for women, no matter where they're working. But I do think there is something left over from the pre-feminist era of modesty and shyness, and you're not supposed to be blowing your own horn.
Something.
Ties into what you said and what Professor Lawless said about sort of fundraising and wanting to be supplicant. So I think that there's a lot of complex reasons which we must overcome. California, which is probably the most progressive state in the union, 10 years ago we were at about 32% females in the state legislature. Right now we're down to 23% with the possibility of losing 9 women in 2016, which means we're
getting voted out, or they're just not going to run again?
They're terming out.
Uh-huh.
Most of them are terming out. So they're not being voted out, but they are terming out, and we don't have women. Without recruitment organizations like Close the Gap, we do not have enough women running for these seats.
I like the point you made about women being shy and not tooting their own horns, because that's something that I've talked to people a lot about in a different capacity. And people don't like to brag. And I think there's a difference between bragging and tooting your own horn in a selfie sort of a way, and tooting your own horn as a way of letting others know that you'll take care of things for them, that they can trust you.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is the more female-oriented way of selling yourself to
the
public.
But I think just bragging about yourself sometimes, period, is a way of saying.
Yes, probably, but I mean,
I'll take this off your shoulders. You can count on me.
Yes, but I think women will say that more. It's more maternal. It's more.
Oh,
it's,
there I go.
It's more.
Yeah,
I'm not saying that's bad because I think that I actually think mothers are wonderful and being maternal. There's nothing wrong with it as long as you're not, patronizing to people. Comes from PhD instead of MAT.
But you hear that. You hear that with men also, who are bragging about themselves, so to speak. And what they're really saying is, I'm going to do this. I'm going to take care of things. You can trust me. You can count on me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it should be gender neutral when you're running for office.
Yes.
But I know if I just look at my own, how I feel, and I'm not a youngster. I've been in the workplace for 40 years. I'm 64 years old as I go into my fourth career here. But when I for the last 3 months since I've been running for this office, I say I've never spoken so much about myself.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something in public, that is. You talk mm-hmm. about yourself to your husband, to your family, to your mother, to your father, and to your siblings. But to be in public telling people how qualified I am, which is what you have to do
That's
as a candidate, it does. I mean, the first few weeks of it were extremely uncomfortable for me.
Oh, is that right?
Because I felt that that's something that other people should recognize in you. You shouldn't have to tell them.
There's something to be said about that.
And
yes.
The art is trying to figure out a way for women who might have been socialized and more comfortable being more modest to be able to talk about their qualifications without it sounding like bluster, because I think people look at political candidates, politicians, as being sort of full of hot air in a mm-hmm. lot of ways anyway. So there have to be new ways, and maybe that's what women can bring to the table.
So if you start off, you said it was uncomfortable for you, but if you start the ball rolling, I think soon enough others will do it for you.
Yes, it's true, but I think a 30 or 35-year-old woman hasn't had the resocialization yet in her professional experience and in her social life and her connections to feel confident that that will happen.
What is it that you tell people about yourself that does make you qualified? Why not just dive right in?
Sure. As I said, I've been working for 40 years. I started my life as a community organizer, my professional life as a young social worker. I had my master's in social work. Be a community organizer, and back in the 70s, I was working on the issue of human rights in the Soviet Union, and mm-hmm. I did that for many years in Los Angeles. I then decided to go to law school, and I, for 25 years after that, I practiced law in a private practice, built my own firm.
Specialty?
Specialty was environmental real estate law, representing people who own small parcels of land and small businesses, helping them to comply with all of the environmental regulations that were being propounded in the 80s and 90s. During that period, I was president of the statewide women's bar, where we helped to feminize the bench, working across the aisle with Republican administrations during those years to be able to get more females appointed as judges in the state of California. I helped Sheila Kuehl, who was a very effective and wonderful local. She was state senator and state assemblywoman. Now she's county supervisor. But I helped her and Abby Liebman start the California Women's Law Center, which is a civil rights organization for women
so
and girls.
That's your background. So tell me what is going to happen from forward. What will the world look like?
Well, in general, I hope the world improves because I think right now we're in a sorry state. But I think your question is, what difference will it make that I am in the legislature and what kind of issues I would be interested in working on? And really, there was a recent article in the LA Times Los Angeles Times a few days ago, and a book written by Nancy Cohen, which talked about why women should vote for women. And the point she makes in the book is, all of the studies about women in power indicate that women in the legislature bring completely different kinds of legislation. They have different priorities. Women bring legislation relating to families, relating to workplace, mm-hmm. relating to various issues that directly bear upon the quality of life of women and single women, access to health care, access to justice. One of the great examples of this has to do with the Affordable Care Act. When it was being finalized in the Senate, there was a committee that did some last-ditch efforts to change things and get it all set, ready to be voted on, and it was an all-male committee. And Barbara Mikulski, the great senator, took a look at their product and realized that during this all-male meeting, they had eliminated contraception and mammograms from the Affordable Care Act. And it was only because she had that orientation. She was worried about how this would affect women that she immediately worked to bring back in mammograms and contraception into the Affordable Care Act, which made it part of the final bill. So I think that women bring different kinds of perspectives.
That is astounding, since these men have wives and sweethearts and daughters.
Yes, but I mean, I think the point is not that they don't like women, not mm-hmm. that they were against it, but priorities are different. So it's not that men won't vote for these things, but women will have the added layer of consciousness to make it more of a priority. And I think you see that with Hannah Beth Jackson in Santa Barbara. She just brought to California the most progressive pay equity bill in the entire United States. Now every state is using it as their model. We have a movement towards family leave that Jimmy Gomez brought in. He's a very progressive, wonderful legislator from L.A., supported by women, but he happens to be a very feminist man. But usually it's the women that bring these initiatives to the fore and really press as a priority to have them passed. And that's what I want to do.
Good. What are you involved at all? How does budgeting work? And the reason I ask, oh, you made a little face. I see. Well, I wish this worked.
Or it doesn't work.
We need a television moment. That was just a small little. Okay. What? I mean, you have to delete certain things to make money for other things. Is it fair to ask you? I guess it is. What kind of things you would scrap?
Well, anything is fair to ask. Whether I can give you a really intelligent answer without having been up there, I really can't answer that question directly. But I do know that there's tension. I think the governor has done a great job with his rainy day fund and able to get our budget back on track and out of the red. But on the other hand, there is a lot of concern that many of the important social service programming that had been cut when we were in worst times in California need to be refunded again, I should say, so that we can get back up to a standard, what I would consider standard for our mental health funding and for other kinds of social service networks.
I have a different question, and I noticed this many years ago in San Francisco. It was front page news that $97 million had been embezzled from the Unified School District. And I was just horrified. So I decided I'm going to start a class action suit. That's my property tax money they stole. And I called a friend who does class action, and she said it was on the front page for 3 days running. She said, can you send me some documentation on this? I did a cut and paste. I sent her 3 front page articles. She, I guess, didn't, and I put it in a document. She said, oh, I have never seen such research. I'm so impressed with all you've done. I said, I didn't do anything. I copied the front page. Am I the only person who saw this? Apparently so. And then she said, we can't do anything. It's too criminal. So I started tracking fraud as a little irritation point for myself. And it's millions and millions and millions and billions of dollars stolen from the public trough all the time. What can be done about this?
Well, I think it's an excellent point, because so often people are talking about raising taxes and revenues, producing more revenues.
Put an end to fraud and stealing. You wouldn't have to.
Well, you may still have to, but at least we wouldn't feel like completely bilked as a population. And I think one of the first obligations of the legislature is to look at how we are spending our money currently, mm-hmm. and that includes what safeguards we have in place to be able to prevent this kind of theft from the public trust. We can't honestly go to the people asking for more money unless we're managing the money we have.
I agree.
Effectively.
And also, by the way, if you add in what it costs to prosecute, you can double that $97 million.
Well, I'm
sure
that's true.
It went on for years.
But you could make by the same analogy, you can talk about how much it costs us to house a resident in our state prisons. Mm-hmm. And $150,000 a year per person, and how much better we could use that money in terms of criminal prevention.
If some of those things weren't criminalized in the first place.
Well, I understand that you're doing work in Africa, global work. You want to tell us about that?
Yes. When the Darfur genocide began 12 years ago, my rabbi and I decided that it was long enough that there had been silence in the face of genocide. So many, 48 genocides since the Holocaust, and nobody had really mobilized. So we started an organization called Jewish World Watch, which we decided to educate and mobilize the people, first in Los Angeles, and it's grown far beyond that, to speak out against genocide, to pass legislation that would help, that would bring some kind of benefit to the victims of genocide, and even some foreign policy changes.
When you say benefits, do you mean like kind of therapeutic things that would help them?
Yes, I'm talking about increased aid, increased food allocations, increased medical attention. So we worked with the Darfuri refugees, and one of the incredible projects we did for the Darfur genocide in Sudan started in 2003, and about a half a million Darfuri, Black African Muslims, have been murdered by the Arab Muslim government of Sudan, and there were about 300,000 Darfuri, mostly women and children, that escaped to the neighboring Chad, the neighboring country to the west. And we were able to work with them to bring solar cooking into their into their refugee camp. The women were being raped when they would go out of the camp to get firewood needed to cook their food.
So this way they don't have to leave the camp.
Right. Yeah. So we started a solar cooking project. We had them manufacturing. We were paying them to manufacture the cookers. And we were able to serve about 200,000, at our height, about 200,000 women were using solar cookers, reducing the incidence of rape by about 80% those years. We unfortunately, this past year, because of all the influx of new refugees in the world, the food allocations to the refugees in Chad were severely reduced. And so now they have absolutely no food to eat. So they've been forced to abandon their solar cookers and go out to find food outside of the camp. They're in a very dangerous position. But our organization also moved to Congo and did a lot of work. Over 1,000 women a day today, to this day, continue to be raped in Congo. Ugh. It's a rape of epic proportions.
Well, that's been the case. I've heard that for years and years, that women are raped several times a day. And what can be done about those men?
Well, we actually started a program to be able to sensitize men to how to treat a woman. And it's
ignorance in their
No, the raping is a military act. I mean, the raping is a... So I'm not talking about how to treat a woman in that way, but I'm talking about post-rape. One of the tragedies in Congo, aside from the militias
how
doing...
Seen afterwards.
Right. Aside from the militias doing the rape, which is just horrible. Right.
You saw that with the Boko Haram kidnappers.
Yes, and there's a lot of different... There's 11 different militias in Congo, that all of whom are raping the women, which is a horrible thing. But we were trying to teach the husbands of these women not to abandon the women after they're raped, because one of the cultural stigmas of rape is that a woman who is raped is no longer allowed to live in the village. So you talk about adding horror to horror.
Has that been successful?
We've actually reached about 40,000 men with this project called Sons of Congo. And there have been huge differences, huge changes in the villages, where we get the either the tribal chief, or we have the pastor in the village teaching other people in their village how to behave.
Is there such thing as a next step, that these men who have already learned better than they used to know then go after these other men who are doing the raping?
The men doing the raping are these militias that are opposed to the villagers. So they're different.
Oh, it's a punishment.
The militias come into a village to be able to control the rich mining, the mines in the area. So what they do is they rape the women, so the women leave the village, and then they enslave
the
children.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, so they're aware of that being thrown out of the village after the...
It's part of the whole... That's why it's...
It's a plan.
It's a systematic plan, using rape as a weapon. In this case, it's a weapon for economic advantage.
But I never heard of this such a thing.
Yeah, it's just awful. It's really a horrible, horrible situation. And we have a lot of different programs. We brought a fistula, are the damages to the woman's body after she's been brutally raped. with foreign objects as well as by home militias of men. I mean, I've been there many times. I've met with the women. I've met with the young girls who have been raped. I've been in hospital wards where an 80-year-old woman was raped next to a 4-year-old child that was raped. It's an unbelievable travesty. And it's something that the world needs to know is happening, shine a light on it. And there are actually things you can do about it. There
seems to me that some kind of severe punishment would be in order, but
yeah, we might talk about
sort of
categorical castration of militia men. But it's very difficult to solve the problem. But
yes.
Americans are constantly buying products that are made with the minerals that are at the core of this conflict. And we've had a campaign, a successful campaign, to create conflict-free computer chips because many of the minerals in Congo are the ones used in our digital devices. And there are several companies, most notably Intel, that has actually been able to produce a conflict-free microchip as a result of our advocacy and advocacy of other organizations. So I hope to bring these kinds of solutions, the kind of leadership that I've been able to bring as the founder of this organization and as the president for many years, those same kinds of practical solutions to Sacramento to address some of our problems. One of the things that I've actually been in arguments with warlords in Congo, and I say, if I've done that and I can actually go to Sacramento and make a difference, I really feel that I will be able to take a very strong stand on many issues, including the feminist issues, and not only make legislative changes and oversight changes in the way we do business here, but California has an obligation protecting abortion rights. Our Supreme Court, it's a very scary situation right now where a lot of issues hang in the balance, including Citizens United and campaign finance and abortion rights and so many other issues that if they're not directly relevant in California legislatively, we have a leadership role to play.
When you talk about sensitizing these men in the Congo not to abandon their women, do you ever hear anybody talk about, in this country, for example, raising our sons better so that they don't rape and they don't abandon and they don't do a whole host of other things that call for the need for abortion more than would be otherwise?
I don't hear a lot of conversation at the educational level. I think it's really important that we have those kinds of conversations early on in middle schools and maybe even before as part of overall relationship training. Mm-hmm. And I don't know enough about our Common Core curriculum in the state of California to know what kind of issues relating to relationships.
So you'll find out as soon as you get elected what those are.
I will, and I think it's really important. We can't just leave this to nonprofits and families.
No.
We have to be more proactive.
There has to be a social conscious change.
Right. Yeah, I mean, thank God in California we don't have this epic, you know, rape that you see in so many other countries, but we do have a lot of domestic violence. We have a lot of rape, totally disproportionate to what it should be. It should be zero.
Yes.
People should be treating each other with reverence and respect. But, you know, when you see our national political conversation devolve to what it has, it feels like things are going to become more and more and more crass in
our
society.
Watching it right now is a harsh time to be looking at anything politically with what's going on. People just get so ugly.
Well, but that's
the
fear.
Running for office.
Yes, and when young people watch,
the higher the office, the uglier they get.
I guess, but like this is so visible, and you have young people who think that it's acceptable to call other people names and to undermine people and to be crude.
You also have people who won't vote because they don't want to take part in this kind of ugliness.
That's not the answer. The answer is to vote, but not vote for people who talk like that.
Yes. Okay. Well, I want to thank you for all this information about you and about the world, some of which I had no idea, coddled as
Thank
I
you.
Am in California, I guess.
Well, I have had this incredible opportunity to see things. And once you've seen these evil things, you have to do something about it. So I will continue my work with Jewish World Watch. I hope others will too.
It's a
strong organization, but I hope to also bring leadership and positive change to the state of California.
Okay. So just to shift for a little minute, because I am about love letters and the power that they have, which is huge. If you were to write one right now, do you write letters ever? Not that you would have time to write a letter these days, but
I saved
it only takes a minute. Yes.
emailing in so many ways in a way, has deromanticized the notion of love letters. I saved all my husband's love letters from when we were courting. I have a big box of them because he was away summer when we were very young. But I do write notes. I try to write birthday cards.
Good for you.
Actually writing in longhand and not always on the computer, because I think the computer emails take away the romance of our conversation in so many ways that I think it's really important to tell people how much you love them in verbally and in beautiful
handwriting,
beautiful
because you can't reread a phone call. And what you think you can remember verbally as we get older, maybe we don't. You pull out those letters when you're 90 and it takes you back to your strongest self.
It's true.
You're smiling. Do you get them?
Yeah. I get my husband writes me beautiful birthday cards and anniversary cards.
So you're still doing
it. So we still do that.
Who would get one from you right now that you haven't thought of before?
Haven't thought of before. My mother. My mother's 92 years old and she's a beautiful human being, and I always tell her that I love her, but I don't write her enough.
Oh. Okay, you really should. May I tell you that I did one for my mother when she was 93, and it was just, you know, I had a little. It was actually a scent that reminded me of her when she was young. Mm. It was a lipstick. It was a Revlon lipstick, and different cosmetics have different scents. And the scent of that lipstick took me back, and I wrote a letter, and I just talked about her at that stage in her life. And she read it, and every time I went to visit for the next 4 years, every time I went to visit, she said, you know, I read that letter you wrote to me, and she went on about it. Now, you think maybe she was getting a little dotty because she kept saying the same thing? No. She actually read it time and again, and every time she read it, she was strengthened.
I'm going to go home and write a letter to my mother.
Do it.
And also my sisters. I have two incredible sisters that I love very much, but we don't write enough to each other, and I really want to do that as well.
I hope you
do. So you've inspired me to do that.
And by the way, you're a big part of history. You're a part of American history. The minute you decide to do anything for the public and let somebody find that in 50 or 100 years in your handwriting.
All right. All right. Well,
I mean, to leave a trail, you know, sometimes you find letters that somebody finds a stash of letters that Jefferson wrote, and it's like the world was created anew. Oh, do that for.
I will. And I'll write one to my daughter. I have a wonderful daughter and she's incredible, and I don't write her enough either. So indeed.
So your great grandchildren will find this someday.
God willing, I'll have great grandchildren. Right now I have no grandchildren. I have three kids and no grandchildren.
Okay. Well, then a stranger will find them and be thrilled. Somebody will find them.
All right.
Oh, good. I hope you do. Thank you, dear, so much for doing this with me. And
thank you.
Again, this is Janice Kaminer-Resnick. And Janik Allen saying goodbye. And Janice Kaminer-Resnick, you'll hear from again in some aspect.
June 7th, vote.
Okay, good. And me, you'll hear from next week. Thank you. And I just want to remind you that if you think you need to wait for a special occasion to write a love letter, writing a love letter is a special occasion. And why not leave a trail of your personal history behind you?
Beautiful.
Bye. Thank you.